If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. What does it mean to take the king's shilling? What was it like to fire a cannon in the heat of battle? And what does the phrase, letting the cat out of the bag, have to do with life at sea? For our latest Everything You Wanted to Know episode, we're discussing the age of sail. Digital section editor Kev Lotchen spoke to the naval historian Kate Jameson, who answered your questions on this highly romanticised period of maritime history.
Kate, I thought a great place to begin would be a question from Sandy Richardson 1505 on Instagram, who simply asked, when was the age of sail?
And that's a great question, actually, because there are so many different answers depending on who you speak to. So I mean, obviously, sailing as a concept has existed for thousands of years, and you can go into battles at sea through, well, all the way back throughout history. But I mean, the age of sail, as people kind of think of it today, I guess, would have started probably in the 1300s, 1400s. You've got your continental discoveries. You've got America being discovered in 1492, for example. And I guess really it's that kind of long 14th, 15th century through to the 19th century. You've got international trade by sea. You've got huge naval battles that we all know about today, which were absolutely dominated by sea. And I mean, if you're looking at the history specifically of the Royal Navy, which is what I do, then I mean you can find a naval battle on almost every day of the year if you try to. But it goes all the way through, like I said, from sort of the 1300s, 1400s through to, I guess, the 19th century, really, when steam started to come in.
And within that period, is it possible to distinguish the golden age of sail, as it's sometimes called?
Yeah, I mean, I think for most people that I've spoken to, certainly, that kind of golden age of sail, if you ask people about it, is usually around the kind of 1700s, 1800s, that time period that everybody thinks of with the French Revolution. You've got the Napoleonic Wars, and you've got these battles being fought out around the globe, really. In you've got the Nile in Egypt, for example. You've got things going on in the Caribbean. That's kind of the time period, I guess, that people romanticize and think of when you think of these square rigged ships and fighting in these fleet battles, etc. But you've also obviously got all of the exploratory voyages, so Captain Cook or Magellan, etc., going off on all of these little adventures around the world, and they've been hugely, hugely important for science, for research, for navigation, etc.
Yeah, it's such a huge part of history. Ado Mohammed on Instagram, he asked, when does the age of sail reach its kind of pinnacle? I mean, you mentioned Napoleonic Wars. Most people, I think, are very familiar with that. Is that the kind of period, or would you say extends a bit later on?
the Napoleonic Wars obviously are, I guess, that kind of age of sail proper that people think about. But if you're thinking about that, whether there's an expiry date per se for the age of sail, then I guess the last battle that you have with sailing vessels on either side is the Battle of Navarino in 1827. But you've still got sailing ships. I mean, and the Cutty Sark is a prime example, really. One of the fastest ships in the world, carrying tea back from China back in, what, 1860s. I don't want to give an actual year because I'm really, really bad at dates. But throughout the 19th century, you'd have these tea clipper ships competing with each other, really, to see who could get the tea back from China to Britain, etc. So whilst the age of sail is kind of thought to have finished when steam came in and these steamships, actually, you still had sailing ships taking things like grain, even in the Second World War in places like Australia.
We've talked about ships there, so that's a good segue, because lots of people want to know more about the ships themselves. Isla Cherie on Instagram, she asks, how does ship design change throughout the age of sail? Because I think there's a kind of popular perception that there's this kind of one ship, the kind of grand galleon, lots of masts, lots of sails. But how does it evolve? Because this is a period of centuries we're talking here.
Yeah, and like we've already discussed, it's such a huge topic. But I mean, if you think about ships kind of... I mean, most of my focus, sorry, is going to be on a British Royal Naval sort of perspective, because that's my topic. But the Tudor Navy kind of were the first to sort of have this sort of class of ship, I guess. It got abandoned and then it came back in. And then it was actually Pepys who came up with that kind of ship rating that we have, that we know of today for the time period. So your first rates, your second rates, your third rates, etc. And they were your ships that kind of formed your line of battle. But in terms of standardizing classifications, it didn't really happen until, like I said, the kind of 17th, 18th centuries. The French were pretty good with it. They had blueprints and tended to work off of those for most ships. And actually, if you look at a lot of British ships, one of the ship designers essentially provided this sort of classic design for a ship in the Napoleonic Revolutionary sort of time period. And you would look at these ships and they were all built to the same kind of standard. They were the same sort of amount of guns and things. Thomas Slade, that's his name, Thomas Slade. And actually a lot of his ships were at Trafalgar altogether. Some of them on our side, some of them had been taken by the French. So you had all of these ships kind of fighting each other, but they were all built to the same design by that point in time, or at least a very, very similar design.
It's really fascinating, isn't it, that journey. And at William Wanty for Instagram would like to know, because we just talked about war very quickly in there, what is the best warship in the age of sail?
Oh, that's such a tricky question. It depends what you class as the best, really. You've got your frigates, which are fast and speedy, and you could go and use them for reconnaissance and go in and out of ports, etc. But then you've got your first rates, your second rates, your big ships that would be in your line of battle, which... obviously, if you're fighting a battle, then they're your kind of best warships, I guess. Obviously, one of the most famous today is HMS Victory, purely because she exists. But it really depends on what you are classing as best, because obviously the crews, the skills for gunnery, etc., the seamanship ability all come into play there. I mean, the largest ship you had at Trafalgar was the Santissima Trinidad, for example, when they think actually one of the largest ships in the world at the time. But actually, at the Battle of Trafalgar, the percentage of trained crew was minuscule. So amazing ship, amazing technology, but perhaps not great at fighting in that kind of traditional sense, I guess.
You've said lots of things we're going to pick up on very shortly. But perhaps a good question to ask as a follow-up now is, which type of ship would you want to captain in that period?
Ooh, I think I'd go for a frigate. They got to do some pretty cool things. They got lots of prize money, went off and did their little intelligence missions. I think that would be quite fun. So I don't know if people have seen Hornblower. The Indefatigable, of course, is a frigate. Lovely, lovely ship. And actually based on a true story as well.
Funny enough, that is one of my questions, so we'll segue straight into that now. Hornblower was a real person?
No. So Hornblower himself wasn't a real person, but obviously C.S. Forrester based him on plenty of real naval officers who existed at the time. So a lot of the stories that are in the Hornblower books, the sort of missions he goes on, etc., they were based on Nelson, they were based on Gordon, they're based on Cockburn, etc. And actually, you've got people like Cornwallis, you've got Pellew, etc., appearing throughout these books. So they're all these huge, famous naval names. It's kind of why people think Hornblower was a real person, but it's kind of an amalgamation, I guess, of all these different naval officers and all of the exciting things they got up to, put into one. But I think it's a really interesting one and a fantastic, fantastic series of books.
I think we should probably talk about, it's such a volatile time in terms of the global stage. Could you just chat for us very quickly how the events of the Age of Sail influence international alliances and the balance of world power?
Like I said, you're going all the way through from these times of discovery through to these huge, huge wars, really, the Napoleonic Wars, etc. And at this point, you've got allegiances between countries changing rapidly, actually. You've got Spain declaring war at a different time to France, and then suddenly they'll come back out of it and then they go back into it. And you've got all of these different nations trying to build their empire, really, and kind of increase their global footprint. And it's just a huge, huge topic to discuss. But obviously, without all of these navies, without these fleets, this merchant trade, etc., all of these things tie in together to be able to make that happen, that kind of empire drive, I guess.
Yeah, it's absolutely huge, isn't it? One specific one we had in from NJ Carvalho, they wanted to know a bit more about Portugal's role in alliance with Britain. What can you tell us about the significance of that within this period?
I mean, Portugal and Britain, I think, have had one of the longest alliances going in history. I mean, it goes all the way back to, I think, the 1300s. It's huge. I mean, even today, we're still very close with Portugal. And obviously, at the time, you had the French and Britain fighting all the time. Then the Spanish joined in. And obviously, Portugal was very, very close to this. So having this allegiance with Portugal was incredibly important. And when you move through the kind of history, I know that we vaguely mentioned before we started recording about spices, for example. Portugal were a huge nation. And they became incredibly rich through this kind of domination of this spice trade, really. And so those commercial benefits that having a kind of alliance like that with Britain brought were fantastic. And obviously you get to the Peninsular War and you've got these sort of Anglo-Portuguese troops fighting under Wellington and things, sort of fighting against Napoleon. It's such a huge, hugely important alliance. And like I said, it still continues today, really.
That, I hope, serves as a good overview for the Age of Sail in general. What we're going to spend a fair bit of time talking about now, where a lot of our questions are about, is what life is actually like at sea for sailors during this time. We did talk a little bit about battles. You mentioned Trafalgar earlier. Could you describe a typical battle for us? You know, is it common for there to be this loss of cat and mouse and then suddenly one kind of short, sharp exchange of broadsides, that's it? Or do they each become more long, drawn-out affairs? Like, what's most likely to have happened?
So you get a real mix, to be honest. There are a number of battles that sort of started with lots of chasing, or, you know, you start fighting and then the weather turns and you're in thick fog, and so suddenly you take that opportunity to do the repairs that you need to do to your ship. But then the next day the weather clears and you're fighting again. And it was quite common for some battles to go on, you know, multiple days, because you didn't tend to fight at night. One of the interesting stories, I guess, kind of relating to Nelson especially, is the Battle of the Nile, because by the time they actually sailed into Aboukir Bay, it was about 5 o'clock in the evening. So they actually continued fighting in the dark, which confused the French immensely. And actually, they ended up firing on their own ships. It was not a great situation for them. But the kind of the typical battle in terms of lining out, you would have your lines of battle, so your first rates, your second rates, your ships of the line, essentially. And they would line up alongside a counterpart and they would fire on each other, essentially, until the other gave in. One of the interesting things, when you go further through, you've got the Battle of the Saints, for example. So Nelson wasn't the first to do it. You've got these ships kind of breaking the line of battle and coming in at a different angle and kind of separating that fleet. And there are a number of reasons for doing that. You can fire shots throughout sort of the full length of a ship, which is absolutely devastating, knocking guns off carriages and killing so many people, which obviously your aim is to stop that ship from firing back. But in terms of there being like a set battle format, no, absolutely not. They changed so much. And talking about cat and mouse, actually, Nelson spent a good few months before Trafalgar chasing Villeneuve across the Atlantic and back, etc. So there was a little bit of that. But yeah, I mean, it just depended. The weather played a huge part in most of them, obviously, because you're at sea and you're held to account by the weather most of the time.
You mentioned ships of the line there. Could we just clarify that bit of terminology?
So your ships of the line, obviously, were your ships that would fight in a line of battle. So as we discussed earlier, through that ship design, you would have your first rates, which are your largest ships, which are kind of 100 guns and up, etc. And essentially it went down through reducing in the number of guns and crew, etc., as you went all the way down to, I think, sixth rate was the lowest that you would get.
I've noticed you use the hashtag on Twitter, gunnery is funnery, which I absolutely loved. What was it like to fire a cannon? Because it doesn't... Was it actually fun?
No. I just think it's a great little saying that people have picked up from somewhere and I love it. But no, absolutely not. It was so much work. And it was horrible. I don't know if you've seen Master and Commander. There's an excellent depiction of a gunnery drill there, which shows it almost perfectly. You know, you've got all these guys crowded around a gun and they're swabbing the barrel to get rid of any of the loose embers from previously so that you didn't accidentally set off the gunpowder prematurely. And then you would put your cartridge in and you'd prick it, etc. But there were so many risks. I mean, like I said, if you hadn't swabbed it out properly, your gunpowder could catch there before you've even fired the gun. You're running out this incredibly heavy piece of metal. If it comes off a gun carriage, for any reason, it will fly back across the ship and it would just be devastating. The amount of crush injuries and horrible stories you see from the gun crews are mad, really. But it's incredibly technical, actually. So I'm doing some research at the moment into gunners in the Royal Navy, and the level of mathematics relating to the angles of fire and the quantities of gunpowder, like different quantities, it's kind of chemistry based, I guess. There's so much more to it than people think, but yeah, certainly not fun. You're right down there in the thick of it, really, with other people firing at you. So the evolution, I guess, in technology meant that it was somewhat easier for the British going forward. So instead of using a linstock slow match, you could have a flintlock, etc., which would fire everything at once. So you had all of these sort of developments in technology that made your life a little bit easier, I guess. But it was incredibly dangerous and certainly not funnery.
It does sound incredibly risky. Is it the riskiest place to be in a battle?
Ooh, tricky. Yes and no. I think those of you up on the top deck really are the ones that are going to get fired at the most, certainly in the sense that you would generally have sharpshooters on the other vessels firing at you. It's much easier for them to pick you off than if you're below decks. But the amount of ships that, you know, like I said, if you had a shot that went down, a raking shot that went down through the length of your ship from stern to bow, for example, like from the back to the front of the ship, it would knock the gun carriages off and it would take all of these different people out. And there's splinters flying everywhere. There's smoke. It would have just been a horrible place to work, really. And there are so many people that had hearing problems. And I've seen about people having their ears literally bleeding from the noise, etc. Just, I think there's this kind of romance with the age of sail. But when you think about it from a kind of practical perspective, actually, pretty grim.
The other part of the battle we should talk about is when ships get into close quarters and we have boarding parties. I mean, how common was that first? And then we have another question from Antique Steel, who just wants to know about boarding weapons. What were the most important ones?
Yeah, so boarding was incredibly common. Actually, there's a famous story of from the Battle of Cape St. Vincent of Horatio Nelson taking a ship, boarding it, and then cross-decking from that ship to another ship and boarding that as well. And it became known as Nelson's Patent Bridge for boarding first rates. So yeah, it was incredibly common. And kind of the goal of boarding really was to get onto that ship and overrun the personnel on board so that you can capture it or destroy it or whatever your aim is, but essentially to get rid of the guys who were on there. And obviously most of the time this was sailors that were doing it, or you might have your Marines on board for the Royal Navy, or your regular troops. Some troops had army on them. And essentially, yeah, the plan was to get over and overrun it. You'd have anything from, you know, grenades, pistols, you'd have bayonets. They had the naval boarding pikes, and of course boarding axes, which were incredibly popular purely because A, they were a weapon, B, you could, you know, crash through doors or open anything that's shut, cut through any lines that had come across. And then also there's kind of, I guess, more from a stealth perspective, there's the concept of kind of cutting out boarding, which is, so you'd have small boats and you'd usually go in at nighttime. The ship would be anchored somewhere completely unsuspecting of you turning up to try and take them. Mostly happened in the Napoleonic Wars, actually. I think the Hermione was probably the most famous example, but it kind of gives you that element of surprise and you're sneaking on, a bit like the scene in Pirates of the Caribbean where they go up and climb up the sides of the ship.
Tell me about the Hermione, because this might be a very daft question, but if you're coming in a small rowing boat, surely you can see this huge ship that's come from somewhere in the distance.
Well, I mean, you'd think so, but it depends where you are as well. So I've heard of it happening where there's kind of an inlet and the ship is anchored in the inlet and you're around the headland and you just sort of sneak around. And of course, if it's dark or the weather's bad or there's like kind of mizzly rain or fog, then you can still have that element of surprise depending on how quiet you are. And obviously making sure you've got no lights, dimming the lamps, etc., is crucial really to be able to have that element of surprise.
Johnny Watkins on Facebook, he would really love to know about the diets that sailors had. He asks, beyond salt beef, fish, ale, etc., what would a more unusual rations that they might have?
It's a good question. Obviously the standards were, like he said, the salt beef, you'd get your beer, which when you hear about the sailors being given, I think it was like a gallon of beer a day, you think that's a lot. I don't know if I could drink that. But actually the percentage was something like 1-3%. So it wasn't anywhere near the kind of beer that you might get if you go to the pub here. But yeah, mostly it was that kind of salted beef and pork and oatmeal. You did get cheese if there was some left. I think Captain Cook famously gave his crew sauerkraut, which is, I guess, a slightly niche one. It helped, or he thought it helped fight scurvy. There's a sailor called Jack Nastyface who's written a memoir. It's a great name. I don't think it was his real name, obviously, but he talks about some of the food that they get given, and he mentions burgoo, I think, which is basically oatmeal and water. And then he also talks about this thing called Scotch coffee, which is basically burnt bread, which you then boil in water, but you sweeten it with sugar. It's not something that I particularly would choose, but I guess that's a slightly different one. One of the main meals they would have would be a thing called lobscouse, which was basically the meat, onions, pepper, and I think they chopped up the ship's biscuit that you see in, you know, Master and Commander with the weevils, and sort of put it in with that and stew it together. And obviously then you'd have your wine, your beer, your grog, etc. And depending where you were in the world, you could add different things. So obviously lemon and lime, crucially important to stop scurvy. But there are stories of people catching turtles or sharks or even seagulls, I think. There's a story of a crew on the ISIS, I think, in Gibraltar, where they shoot seagulls and eat them. So slightly different, but I think a lot of it came from, especially when you're away, what you could make the best of, really.
There's much more varied diet than I'd realised. I hadn't really thought about the live hunting aspect. You mentioned Scotch coffee there. Have you tried to make it?
I haven't, no. It doesn't appeal to me, actually. I mean, I burn bread all the time, but I haven't thought about mixing it in with water and sugar. I think I'll avoid that one. I have tried ship's biscuits, though. I have made those before, the hardtack, very sort of salty kind of biscuit type hard bread, I guess, really. But not great, but obviously it did what it needed to do.
And hopefully weevil free.
Definitely weevil free, yeah.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
But you'd always have, you know, maybe like a kraken, the giant sort of octopus in a corner of the world. And partly that was because there was a big blank space of water that they needed to fill. But also, I mean, it kind of was a visual depiction of the fact that people didn't know what was out there.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
One of the more popular search queries in this area is, of course, about scurvy, which you mentioned. Could you just tell us a little bit about what that is and why it was such a problem in this period?
Yeah, so scurvy is a horrible, horrible illness. And actually, it's still going on today. I saw a news article last week about scurvy being a problem because people weren't eating fruit and vegetables. And essentially, that's where it comes from. It's that not having the fresh produce. So now we use limes, lemons, or they started using limes and lemons because they worked out that actually that assisted, because it was the vitamin C aspect. If you don't get enough vitamin C, you end up, you know, your teeth would fall out and you would have gums sort of rotting. And it was a really horrible, horrible disease, I guess. But yeah, it's essentially based on the fact that you don't get enough vitamin C. And the way that the Navy went about this was obviously introducing that vitamin C. So obviously you can't really get fresh fruit and vegetables as you would now. You can just pop and go, oh, I should probably have eaten a bit more broccoli this week. I'll go and buy some. But they would put lime juice in with the rum, etc., just to kind of ensure that people were kind of getting that vitamin C in without them having to just sit there munching on a lime, for example. I don't think anyone would want to do that. I think they previously thought that there were cures in the sense of, you know, like bloodletting and drinking sulfuric acid and all these horrible things. But it transpires that, yeah, you just vitamin C. And like I said, Captain Cook famously gave his guys sauerkraut. But yeah, James Lind, the surgeon, was the guy that actually ran this kind of, I guess, a clinical trial of sorts to try and come up with a cure for it. They actually took, I think it was 40 or 50 years after he ran this trial for the Navy to actually go, oh yeah, okay, we'll actually do that and start issuing it properly. But it definitely helped, and they think that's actually why British sailors have come to be known as limeys.
So we've talked about bleeding ears, we've talked about rotting gums. I feel a bit queasy. Trey Seeker on Instagram would love to know what kind of medical care there was on vessels in this time.
I mean, the concept of having a doctor or a surgeon on a ship goes way back. I think it was actually Emperor Hadrian that had a surgeon on all of his ships. They were paid almost two or three times as much as the other officers because of the level of importance. But You've got the Mary Rose. They obviously had a surgeon. You can go and see the surgeon's equipment that they recovered from the wreck, which I always find fascinating. And actually, a lot of the equipment that you would have seen in this time period being used for surgery on board wouldn't look that out of place in a modern operating theatre. I guess that everything kind of has evolved, but essentially much of those are the same. The Royal Navy always put a naval surgeon on board on their ships. They were appointed by the Sick and Hurt Board, but they had to deal with so many different amputations, for example, or those kind of trauma injuries from shot, or even something like removing a splinter. But they also had to deal with scurvy, like we said, or things like yellow fever and even sexually transmitted diseases after the sailors had been into port and spent some time with the locals.
I wonder, how do you perform any kind of surgery at sea when you're kind of moving around with a swell?
Yeah, so the surgeons would have had assistants, obviously. And again, I keep bringing up Master and Commander, but it shows it so well. And you've got them putting the sand on the floor to try and stop the blood being quite so slippery. There was a myth that when HMS Victory, she's not the same colour now, but there was a myth that the deck of Victory had been painted red to kind of hide the blood. But I think that's been very much disproved. But they would have put sand on the floor to kind of stop you sliding around in it. But yeah, you'd be on a table, same as I guess now. But you know, that table would be covered. If you were rolling, you'd be held down and you'd be operated on with no kind of anesthetic in the sense that we do today, crucially. Just having your arm lopped off with maybe a bit of leather to bite on and some laudanum or something.
Another question we had from Tracy on Instagram related to this was, did women give birth on ships? And we should probably talk a bit more about how many women were present on ships during this period of time as well. Was that a common thing?
Fairly. I mean, there's a story of from Trafalgar of actually one of the British ships going over to a French ship and actually picking up a survivor who'd lost her husband and she was on board. I mean, the Admiralty didn't really officially allow women on board, but quite often you'd have the wives of maybe your warrant officers, like your gunners, your surgeons, etc., or other officers join the ship. But they had to share the cabins or the hammocks, etc. They had to share their food rations. They didn't get their own food rations, so that had to be split between them. But yeah, quite often you would have women on board. There's a great story. I can't remember the ship, but essentially she was due to be giving birth and she'd been in labour for something like 12 hours. So basically the surgeon went and asked if they could fire a broadside in order that it would kind of shock her body into pushing out this baby. And she did. She ended up having a baby off the back of this broadside being fired. But yeah, so there's a great paper that was written recently that actually covers the wife of one of the gunners looking after the midshipman, kind of being a bit of a mother figure to the younger kids on board. You'd have your powder monkeys, for example, who are very, very tiny children. So the powder monkeys were used to kind of run the gunpowder up from the magazine where the gunner was up to the gun crews. So tiny little nimble children with their buckets of gunpowder taking it up for firing.
We did talk about queasiness earlier, or I certainly did. KB De Ginger on Instagram asks how sailors combated seasickness.
Ooh, interesting. So I'm not 100% positive or 100% certain on this. I've not actually seen that much about it without people saying that they either watched the horizon to kind of equal it out in their brain, to kind of equal it out, which is actually something they tell you to do now, is watch the horizon because it focuses you. But a lot of people, I think, would have probably chewed on ginger or spices. Ginger is a big one. And I think even now they say that if you're feeling a bit queasy, you should chew on ginger. So if they had any of that available to them, then probably. But I think a lot of the time you just kind of had to get on with it. I mean, Horatio Nelson famously got seasick really, really badly and said that it confoundedly put him out of humour. But in his kind of classic Nelson way, he always kind of tied it back to duty and said, you know, it's my service to my country keeps me at sea, even though I'm, you know, unwell or seasick or whatever.
Speaking of service to your country, that seems like a good way to jump into a question from Will Pride 18 on Instagram, who wanted to ask about impressment, because we should probably say not everyone who was at sea in this period was a volunteer.
No. Although there's been some really interesting work carried out recently by a chap called Jeremiah Dancy, who's actually, he sat and went through all of the muster books of all of these ships, which must have taken, well, in fact, it did take years, and actually found out that the number of people that were pressed rather than volunteered is a lot less than we think. So more people volunteered than we think. But essentially, you'd have these press gangs, as everyone knows them, going around these kind of shipping nautical towns, port towns, and finding people to crew the Navy. I mean, obviously, you're going from peacetime, where you don't really need anyone, to suddenly a period of war where you may need upwards of 20,000 men. And so you'd have these press gangs set up in towns, Portsmouth, Plymouth, Chatham, etc. But really, there's kind of this myth, I guess, where people think of the press gangs going into pubs and going, you're coming with me, you look able-bodied, taking people away from their houses, etc. And well, it did happen, and you'd have your landsmen who had never really been to sea before, but essentially you didn't particularly want them. You needed people who'd been to sea, who knew their way around a ship and understood how to deal with the sails or heave on lines or fire guns if they could. So really, it was kind of those merchant navy men that you would want. But you also had to be very aware that you didn't want to leave the merchant fleet with nobody. Otherwise, you've sort of messed everyone around. But yeah, I mean, impressment was a huge, huge thing, but it's nowhere near the quantities that people believe.
And a follow-on question from Hannah Law, originally on Instagram. Were press gang sailors also paid?
Yeah, absolutely. You couldn't just take people and not pay them. Yes, that's how you end up with mutinies on your hands. But yeah, absolutely, they were paid. There's kind of a pay scale. So I've actually got a poster behind me that's got the able seaman being offered £5, the ordinary seaman £2.10, and those landsmen that I mentioned that hadn't maybe been to sea before just got 30 shillings. So there was a pay scale, much as there is in the Royal Navy today, but people definitely got paid.
I mean, speaking of impressment as well, there's a very common Google query about what it means to take the king's shilling, and that is tied into the myth offices of impressment. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so there's a really interesting story, actually, that, you know, the king's shilling is kind of this token that you're given as a sign of impressment, and there's supposedly a pub in Portsmouth where the landlady used to drop the shilling into the beer, meaning that when they drank it, they, you know, the king's shilling is there and right off to sea with you. And it's a myth. It's a nice myth, but I don't think I don't think you'd have been able to get away with it to the extent that people think they did. But supposedly she recruited like hundreds of people for the Navy in this method, this landlady in Portsmouth. It's quite a fun little story.
You mentioned very briefly that you would want sailors over, you know, random people from the pub, because you want people to know to sail and have the right discipline. How did discipline work on vessels at this time? And, you know, what kind of punishments were meted out for infractions? I mean, there's another quite popular Google query about what it means to be tarred and feathered.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the punishments that you would get on board a ship were a deterrent. I think that's the best way to look at it, is that they're not supposed to be a nice little disciplinary chat with your commanding officer. They were to deter you from doing it again, but also to put other people off doing the same thing. So you hear nowadays people saying letting the cat out of the bag, or not enough room to swing a cat. And actually those terms come from the Royal Navy, and your cat of nine tails, which was kind of a handle with nine pieces of rope with little knots tied in them, and you would be flogged with it. And it was the most uncomfortable, painful thing. And that would be your most common punishment, really, was a flogging. The rest of the crew would be made to watch. And they'd either use the end of a rope or they'd use the cat. As well as that, you obviously had people being, sometimes you'd be caned. I've seen examples of people being caned. You're tarred and feathered, obviously, as you said. But flogging by far was the gravest, the most common. The gravest, obviously, if you were guilty of mutiny or murder, was that you'd be hung from the yardarm. We've all heard the saying of being hung from the yardarm, but that would happen. I think the worst punishment, I've not actually seen that many cases of it happening, was a flogging round the fleet. But essentially, the ships that were in the port at that time would send people, the crews would be mustered on deck, and this chap would be sent around to each of the ships and flogged by each ship. And it was very rare that you would actually survive that, if I'm honest.
We mentioned pay very briefly, but one other thing you picked up on earlier was prize money. Do you think you could tell us what that is and how it ties in?
Yeah, so essentially you would, like I said, your frigates were the ships that really made the most, I guess, in prize money. And if you've seen Hornblower, they talk about it quite a lot, you know, the prospect of this prize money from taking other ships, really. And I guess it kind of meant that you'd capture an enemy ship, essentially. The Navy would purchase it, and that, again, would then be kind of split. Officers would make the most. The crew would get a small part of it. But that's essentially the gist of it, really, is that you would capture an enemy ship, the Navy would buy it, and then the money got sent. I mean, I think for a normal sailor, it was a case of a few shillings. So you weren't doing that well. But a lot of captains ended up with these massive stately homes ashore, which they'd bought with the amount of prize money that they'd made.
So officers seem to do quite well out of it. If you are a everyday sailor, it's not going to make you rich.
No, but it would be a nice little addition, I guess, to your, if you made it onto a ship that was pretty nifty at actually capturing other ships, then you'd make more. But it depended on your ship, depended on your crew, and depended as well, I guess, on the ship that you actually managed to take.
What about if you fell overboard? I remember Master and Commander, there's a brilliant scene of someone falling overboard in a storm. I mean, how likely you survive that scenario out at sea?
I mean, if you're spotted, then you would survive. But I mean, there are stories of people falling overboard and never being seen again, certainly. And I mean, that still happens today. I mean, if you think about the size of a person, and if you think about how rough these seas can get, you're trying to spot somebody in the dark, especially if it's dark. It would be incredibly difficult if you've got a storm raging, you can't hear them shouting. And I mean, even today, you see people, there are a lot of videos online of people in life jackets, and you've got these fluorescent yellow hoods, but you can still barely make them out against the sea. Life at sea was incredibly dangerous in so many ways.
Yes, very definitely. I mean, what other ways are you thinking of there?
Oh, obviously, if you're on a Navy ship, there's the battle aspect. But I mean, the weather, hideous. You're not in great conditions. You haven't got the best. You haven't got all this nice Gore-Tex sailing jackets and things that you've got today. You'd have tarred clothes. You've got the illnesses going around without that kind of modern medicine that we've got today. You've got the possibility of falling from the rigging. You've got the possibility of being captured or fired on, like I said. There's just not a nice, not a great environment to work in. Damp, dark conditions quite often. The Navy ships were slightly better in the sense that people had, you know, regular provisions, etc. But just not a great place to be, essentially, in the grand scheme of things, unless you're an officer and then you're sort of there in your cabin with your nice mutton at night time and your sort of people serving you coffee when you want it, etc.
But not Scotch coffee,
no. Actual coffee. I think it's the Master and Commander books are really good, actually. They're quite heavy going to read, but they give you such a good idea of life in the Navy at that time.
How do the Master and Commander books feel about piracy? It's a very common trope that piracy is a big part of this period. Is that accurate?
I mean, pirates have been part of history since ancient times. I mean, you've still got pirates today as well. So pirates are a huge problem, but less so for the Royal Navy. I don't think pirates are that stupid to try and take on the. It happens today. There was a ship recently that took on a Danish ship in the Gulf of Guinea. Some pirates took on a Danish Navy ship recently. But throughout this kind of 16th, 17th century, which is sort of the golden age of piracy with your, I don't know, Captain Kidd and Blackbeard and these kind of famous names, it was a big deal. And obviously, the whole concept of pirates, they're trying to make their money, aren't they? And they get their ships and sell it and make the money. And everyone's trying to do the same thing. I mean, if you look back through history at, you know, corsairs or privateers even, and obviously I think Francis Drake's famously described as a privateer, although I think a lot of people dispute that kind of naval tie, privateer type, bit of a controversial chap. But you know, that if you think about it in the context of the time, there aren't that many jobs at home. People don't have the kind of, if you're not going to sea in the Navy, there aren't that many jobs realistically. If you're from a city, again, you need to find something to do to make money, and people had to kind of work out how to do it. And piracy tempted these kind of lower paid seamen or merchantmen, for example, because they kind of had a bit more control and they were sold on the whole story of being able to make loads of money. And obviously that didn't particularly happen all the time, but it's the same now, isn't it? You get offered a get rich quick scheme and people want to take it because they're in a dire situation. So
I mean, one thing I remember from the Pirates of the Caribbean films is that idea that pirates were often sailors first. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, you can't sail a ship otherwise. I mean, there's that great scene, isn't there, in Pirates of the Caribbean, where you've got Jack and Will and they get onto the ship and flapping the lines around. There's absolutely no way that they could have sailed that ship out of the harbour with two people, purely because of the amount of sails that you would have had to put out. But it's they're great films. I love them. But piracy was a big problem. There are some really interesting people on Twitter working on sort of new histories of pirates at the moment. And it's fascinating.
I mean, one other danger that Jessica Roberts on Facebook asked about is sea monsters. How common was belief in sea monsters, and what monsters would they have believed in if they did?
Quite a few people believed in them. I mean, if you look at some of the old charts and maps, and most of them were for kind of decorative purposes, but you'd always have, you know, maybe like a kraken, the giant sort of octopus, in a corner of the world. And partly that was because there was a big blank space of water that they needed to fill. But also, I mean, it kind of was a visual depiction of the fact that people didn't know what was out there. You know, there could be these giant krakens or leviathans or the mega sharks, what are they called? Megalodons, I think, the giant sharks. And people just didn't really know. And then obviously you bring into it things like mermaids or sirens. And there is a lot of superstition and myth at sea, even to this day. Things like not being able to take bananas on board. I'm not quite sure where that one came from, but there's so many, you know, myths and stories. And I guess also you're away from sea for a long period of time and you don't particularly go anywhere or do anything. And I imagine that maybe it kind of came from a kind of an imagination perspective as well. It gives a little bit of danger to your voyage. So when you go back and tell your stories, what did you do? We sat there for weeks on end, bored out of our tree when we weren't actually sailing anywhere or fighting. But, you know, there was a giant octopus that came and fought us, etc. I find them all fascinating. I love it. I've got some little sea monster models that I'm painting at the moment. So, I mean, I like to think that the concept of mermaids, especially when you think about it from a practical perspective. If you've ever seen dolphins going alongside a ship or a yacht at nighttime, sometimes you get the phosphorescence with all the light coming off the water. And I like to think that maybe that's where the whole concept of mermaids came from, because you see these dolphin tails in the dark with all the sort of sparkly light coming off of it. And that's where I like to think it comes from. And I could quite easily see how you would think that. And if you think about the giant squids that people do see on occasion that wash up on beaches and things, I mean, it's not outside the realms of possibility for people to then be thinking, there's probably something much bigger than this. And I mean, we don't know. There could be. Maybe there's a kraken out there in the middle of the Atlantic somewhere just waiting.
Absolutely terrifying. You did touch on there about how these stories fill up time, and you didn't say, oh, I've been away for so long and being bored out of your tree. But that is an interesting point. How long were these kind of journeys? Because we think about travel as being quite short today. But actually, it was quite a long time away from land, right?
It was a really long time. Sometimes people are away for multiple years at a time. There are stories of people writing a letter, or their families writing a letter saying, this is what happened at Christmas. And by the time they go back to it, you know, it's taken until September to get to them. So it was last Christmas. It was months ago. But yeah, you'd be away for years at a time sometimes.
Were ghost ships a kind of a concern at this time as well?
I've never come across it personally, but I mean, there's the famous myth, or the famous story, isn't there, of the Marie Celeste floating around. So yeah, I've not come across it in any of the research that I've done, but I imagine so. I mean, there's a great story of a ghost ship supposedly in the Solent off the Isle of Wight that apparently Winston Churchill saw when he was a young child. And Prince Edward said that he saw it as well. So whether or not it was just a ship that was in the fog or something, but the myth certainly prevails.
Speaking of myths, this feels like a good question to end on, and it's from Frank Shoemaker on Facebook. And they ask, what is the most enduring myth about the Age of Sail?
Ooh, I think for me it would be the romance of it. There's this kind of idea of these tall ships being crewed by these perfect crews and everyone getting on, and it's a jovial Jack Tar kind of environment. And actually, when you look into it, it like I said, it was a miserable place to work. I don't know that anyone would particularly want to work there unless they had a real love of the sea. And I think it's kind of that myth of the romance that comes with the Age of Sail, I guess, rather than the reality.
That was the naval historian Kate Jameson. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.